the two guys who were supposed to give this talk couldn't come and give the talk because they're so famous and busy.
Okay.
And so I'm just, the great thing about this talk is everything is going to be available on the web. We'll just see the websites, and I'm going to walk you through that. So this is going to be website one. So this is going to be about diffusion geometry, which is a tool for studying data sets. So now the great thing about, there are many great things about large data sets. First of all, they're omnipresent. So our deputy provost at Yale calls this the crisis of biology. Right? That's a gold mine for mathematicians because they have monstrous data sets. They're in extraordinarily high dimension, and they're really complicated. So the analysis is much harder than analysis on Euclidean spaces or manifolds, but we want to use that intuition to get somewhere. So just an example, so why doesn't someone give me some numbers for a number of points of a data set in a certain number of dimensions, and I'll tell you if it's too small. Give me a number of points in your data set.
Too small.
No, too small. That's
too small
easy.
For what?
10 to the 9th.
To store. 10 to the 9th, so that's right at the outside of what you can store. So let's say 10 to the 9 points. And
so a time slice on a 1,000 cube grid.
Right. In R what?
10 to the 8th.
No, not 10 to the 8th. Let me give you a number just, huh?
R 1,000.
Yeah, let's do 5,000. Because that's about what you get when you look at affymetrics chips. Okay? How are you going to do analysis here? So the problem is, so you can't work there. So you'd like to let probability theory do the work for you. And so the short story is you just start searching around for random Gaussians. Those are easy to generate. And then here's what you do. You have this horrifying data set. And now you're going to pick, so let's let n equal, so log of 10 to the 9 is 9. Log 10, which is about, well, it's less than 25. Okay. I'm going to take, in this case, a 25-dimensional hyperplane. So I don't tell you the orientation. How do you find the orientation? You just ask a computer to randomly choose a 25-dimensional hyperplane. How do you do that? You just spit out Gaussians. It comes out immediately. Now you just project orthogonally. Oh, but there's a problem. Maybe your data set is now completely distorted. Theorem, it's not. The distortion is essentially log n, or it's very low. Log n is the number of points. So all of a sudden, you're in R25. That's actually numerically very difficult to work with. But now you can see that you can take smaller data sets like a million, and you really have an effective numerical tool. And this is actually what people do. This is how streaming video is compressed and sent, is by some version of this. So you're sending a much smaller data set, and yet you haven't lost any of the distortion. So roughly speaking, the approximate distance between points is not, well, it's contracted here, but it's not contracted very much. If you pick a random hyperplane. So that's rule number one. So you can take a Euclidean set and probabilistic, you just, this is called the Johnson-Lindenstrauss theorem. It's one of the great pillars of modern data. Well, let's put a star here. So this is the Johnson-Lindenstrauss theorem. There's a converse to the Johnson-Lindenstrauss theorem. It's a moral converse, and it's actually more than that. That's called the Bourgain embedding theorem. And that's the following. So maybe you're a geneticist. You have a huge data set. Yep. And please ask questions. This is really a super.
How do you define the distortion?
Oh, you define the distortion.
Length before and after? Because that's
right.
Totally false, right?
No.
You just take a random point on the sphere.
No.
Well, the exact bound involving epsilon and denominator.
Right. No. So you, the danger is that you have two points and they line up and collapse. But this won't happen. The worst set is to look at the Hamming cube.
Yeah.
So you have two to the n points, now project on n and you see what it looks like. It seems strange. It's the great power of Johnson-Lindenstrauss. Okay? And so then there's a, but of course I didn't define exactly which one to do the distortion. So it's the distance from at pi of x pi of y divided by x modulus of y. And this less than 1 is bounded by constant over log n. Okay, so now, unless I missed the power, did I miss the power?
You want the epsilon?
Yeah.
That's what it
comes
down to. Epsilon. Log n over x squared.
Yeah, that's actually, there's a double distortion. It's usually measured by going. Okay, so then there's the Bourgain extension theorem, and this is great if you're, say, a geneticist, because your data could just be in a vector space. You have different strands of DNA, and you have a vector on them, so you just now have xj with a metric space in a metric space, and the metric is V, and you want to study it. But I don't know about you. I mean, an abstract metric space to me is just impenetrable. But it turns out it's just Euclidean space. So there exists an embedding. Oh, this is unfortunate. It's called the metric row. There's an embedding of this into RD. So how many points do I have? I have n points. D looks like, again, log n, and the distortion is, again, like it has something to do with log n. So it's, log n is very small. So that means you can embed anything, and the great thing for us that this program is, how is this done? Completely probabilistically. So it's one of these amazing Bourgain ingenious constructions. You build various random sets, you compute distances from points to these random sets. That gives you coordinate functions, and for most of the choices of the random sets you get this. You're happy?
Yeah.
Okay, because I'm going to point my finger at you later.
I just want to ask, it's RD L1, it's not L2, right? But it doesn't matter.
Oh, RD with Euclidean metric. Is that what you mean?
It's the L1 metric.
No.
Oh, it's L2.
No, it's important that it's L2.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why should we can apply this result to just R1? If we can.
Then you get to project one point. Right? So if you look at the numerics, this will allow you to project one point. Okay. That's not very useful. So, yes?
I might ask a question, the answer to which I'm sure is no, but so can you tell me why the answer is no? what this is seeming to say is that if you know how many data points you're going to take, you might as well reduce the dimension of the space that the data lives in from the outset and do a simpler experiment.
That is correct, and it's done after the fact. I mean, people do this, and they exactly arrange it so they, well, you can just store random projection.
No, but can't they do even better? We started many talks with people hooking up electrodes to other people's brains. Can't you, if you know how many data points you're going to take, can't you hook up simply fewer electrodes?
It's great that you should mention this, because now Mark Green is going to stand up and tell us about the program on sparse sensors. So Lincoln asked exactly the correct question. Okay, it's not off of distortion.
So actually, if you read the New York Times, this is mentioned in the article about Terry Tao that recently appeared, but not our program, but during the course of this program we had in fall of 2004, Terry and Emmanuel Condes did this work, and so the AMS is having its von Neumann lecture series in July is devoted to this topic of compressed sensing. And we are having a pre-program in May, when many of you will be here. We're going to hold it over in the faculty center so as not to kind of disturb people over here, but we're going to have six younger people in this area are going to lecture on this, and it's intended for beginners in this area, so graduate students, postdocs, or people who are older but who haven't been exposed to this. So, you'll see it. There, we have one of our flyers. There may even be one on the door here, otherwise we'll put one, but the flyers are out there at some time in May, and I think it's 3 days. Anyway, I really want to encourage all of you to come, and also if you have students and graduate students who you might think would like to attend, please encourage them to apply online, because sometime, pretty soon we'll have to start, picking who to give support for, but we do have some support for young people that come to this.
Thank you. And now let me explain why this is all the same. So Lincoln is exactly right. Let me give you an example. So there's something called sparse sensing. It again is something that's all done probabilistically. You just generate random Gaussians, and you somehow convolve your data with it. And here's a great example. So when this was first presented at IPAM, Koifman called up his team and had them write the code for sparse sensors. And within 48 hours, he had the following experiment running successfully. And it's the following. So he has a chemical camera. So this just means that you are computing the spectrum of something. You'd like to take far fewer observations because you're going to put this out in the field, and so you have limitations on how much you can do. And then exactly what Lincoln said is correct. You somehow, if you know something about the spectrum of the chemical you're looking for, you can design the experiment to do very few measurements, and with high probability, you'll pick up the signature. So, and again, all of these things run by randomized algorithms. Everything must be random, because essentially everything is optimal, and there's no way to do it deterministically.
So you have 48 hours to use what Peter's going to tell you.
Right. Okay, so now, Ron, let's start with Mauro. So I'm going to show you Mauro Maggioni's website and Stefan's website. So you can fall asleep, but I'll wake you back up for Stefan's website, because he has the coolest applet you have ever seen. And you'd never realize that eigenfunctions of a Laplace operator on manifolds would help you make cartoons. Okay, real life or movies. Okay, so let's go on here. So the idea is we're going to look at a different type of probabilistic analysis of data sets. So it's going to be via diffusion. It's going to, it turns out, be inherently multi-scale, and it has following applications. I encourage you to go to Mauro Maggioni's website. He has a long list of beautiful tutorials and papers. We have pictures. We'll see some of them. Okay, so let's move on. So the point is roughly the following. We just have data in high-dimensional space. We don't know anything about it, and we want to discover something. So we're just given some data set, and we want to be able to say anything about it. So first of all, these things all come with noise. So anything you do better be statistically robust. Here's the simplest problem. Find intrinsic properties such as local dimensionality, local parameterizations, da-da-da. Let me give you an example. And I can't remember if this is on here. You have tissue samples. You have some known tissue samples, and you know if they are cancerous, precancerous, or not at all. They're healthy. You get new tissue samples you would like to classify. So classical method is do some type of clustering algorithm. Doesn't work. And the reason is the data is too complicated. This turns out to be one of the areas where the Laplace operator that we're going to build is quite helpful in organizing the data for you, which is given, you should think of all data given to you in a completely unstructured manner, and then you want to put structure on it. Okay. So here's an example where we have some digits. They're rotated, there's noise, there's all sorts of garbage. So this looks like what my niece writes on her Christmas cards. You know? And so of course the post office has a very special recognition system for digits, but here's the idea in this, this is kind of a toy model, is that we're given these in unstructured ways. They're just thrown down randomly, and they have these rather nasty forms, and we would like to separate them. So the story that comes a little later is that what we will do is associate to each of these numbers a vector in high-dimensional space. We'll do a random walk on that. There'll be a Laplace operator, and then we'll look at the eigenfunctions of the Laplace operator. And when we use those eigenfunctions as coordinates, we'll pick something like five eigenfunctions, phi j1, phi j2, up to phi j5. We will get a robust description of the entire data set, and it will organize. So it will take this unstructured thing and it'll tell you if it's a 1 or a 4. It'll also tell you if it doesn't know. And you'll have these various porcupine quills sticking out. Here, this is, these are rotated, I guess. Let's go on.
So since this data is from the United States, so how did you handle European 7 types of data?
Oh, that's so the answer is that European 7 will go into a separate cluster, but then all you need to have is an identifier for the cluster of European 7, which, by the way, is the one I used. I like European 7. Right? It will differentiate 7 from American 7. So American 7 is like American politics. No one knows what it is. Right? It's unidentifiable. Okay, let's go. I was shocked to see this up here. I didn't realize this is a lecture that Mauro just gave. So Mauro recently won, in fact, just a few days ago, the Popov Prize, which is for approximation theory. The most recent winner of that is another IPAM-like, Emmanuel Condes. So the point is we did some work. This guy, Will Getzman, who's at Yale, has an amazing collection of art data auctions. And people have a hard time figuring out what's going on from art data auctions. And the short story I just want to tell you is I was quite surprised at how robust this is, because the data set here is very small. PCA, principal component analysis, in other words, linear methods don't give you much information. And it turns out that one was able to discover something here by just taking three eigenfunctions. Let's continue, because we haven't gotten any math. Oh, here's another great application. This is text documents. Okay? So text documents have historically been classified by graph theoretic methods, and while this is a sort of a graph theory method, we're not actually going to build a graph. We won't build a graph. We'll have just the full graph, and we'll put weights on. And it turns out that for interesting reasons, that if you take, say, news articles from eight different categories, they're very difficult to separate, and so there have been various methods using keywords, etc. It turns out nothing works so well, and you get a surprisingly good representation where the different areas, so let's see if I can read this. So we have anthropology, astronomy, social science, earth science, biology, mathematics, medicine, and physics. And so actually this type of problem is extremely important in biology, because the biologists have millions of papers, and simply going through them is an enormous problem. So there are people whose jobs are simply specialized to this. That's what they do their research on, is classifying. Let me give you another example, which is not completely solved. This is really interesting. Classification of popular music. In the 1960s, it used to be possible to classify this pretty well, and Sony Records and all the other record companies knew that there was folk art, and that was not cool after 1965. There was folk music, and there was rock and roll, and that was cool. And then there's rockabilly, and there are a small number of styles. Yes, Mark?
I notice you're not classifying that in the cool and cool category.
Yeah, that is too dangerous, right? So, so Hillary Clinton made a bad comment about country western music that landed her in enormous hot water. And she had to get out of this literally by baking cookies on television. Seriously. She did this. She baked chocolate chip cookies to show that she was a good person and did not dislike country western music. Very complicated story. Let's go on. Okay, so now here I unfortunately have to refer you to a paper, and this is work done by Koifman and Kevorkidis, and the idea is that there's a molecule here. And it's a pretty small molecule, and the molecule can bend, it can rotate, and it has, you know, a few joints, and you would like to describe the dynamics. Okay, so if you're a physicist, you write down all these equations, and then it's a fact that the evolution will obey them, but you gain very little information, and it's a notoriously hard problem, and these guys have a fabulous explanation of how one should understand these pathways. This unfortunately is really a cartoon version of what they have. And the idea is you can trace out the dynamical pathways on a very low dimensional manifold and see how the molecule is moving on this manifold, and with high probability it stays in a certain very, very simple area. And this comes out, again, of building a Laplace operator, taking the eigenfunctions for the Laplace operator, and picking carefully a small number of eigenfunctions. Okay, let's go on. Okay, so, and then, this is the slide people always call truth in advertising. So this has a history. Well, let me not bore you with history. There's a very long history going back easily to 1930 in harmonic analysis, where you start replacing, where you try to understand where to use e to the im theta for a basis and other basis functions, and how to make things fit together. So you take functions, you tear them apart, you put them back together, and you use various bases. Some are localized, some are unlocalized. But of course, for physics, there's always something special about the Fourier basis. And those are eigenfunctions of the Laplace operator. Okay? So let's skip that. Okay, now let's come to the more important thing. So for large data sets, you need fast algorithms. So this turns out for analysts to be really fun, because they are descendants of what's called the Calderon-Zygmund theory. So in Chicago, who lives in Chicago or works at Chicago? There's Ilya, anyone else? So there's something, when I was a professor in Chicago, we called it the salt mine, because graduate students were sent down there to learn the machine. And after 5 years, some of them came back up, but not all of them. In any case, so we have lots of fast numerical methods now that are based on physical principles, multi-scale analysis. We don't have all the fast algorithms we need for what we're going to see later. Okay, let's go on. We have some of them. Okay, let's forget ambient space. New type of harmonic analysis. That's what you write when you need a grant. Okay. Okay, so let's look at a graph. Let's suppose that we have a graph, and this is actually going to be the full graph. So here's the point. I hope you can see it. So we have a data set, and we want to assign a local similarity. So this is exactly what Francois Meyer would do. So we define a kernel. We fix some sigma. That's a standard deviation. And there's some art in picking sigma. And we simply define this kernel. It's a Gaussian kernel. And for strange reasons, I can never understand why some aficionados don't put a square here. Right? It's legal. But
and a half.
And a half, right? Yeah, the half is a scaling factor, so that I can understand, but sigma squared is a violent scaling factor. Okay, so here is now the simple idea. Let's skip all technicalities. But this is obviously this gives you a symmetric matrix, kxy equals kyx, because Euclidean distance is Euclidean distance. Let's turn it into a doubly stochastic matrix. And the transition probabilities should look like this. Okay? How to do that? There's a little bit of finesse, but let's just assume this is right. So you have to do stuff with the density of points and sigma. But okay, suppose you can do that. Okay, so then, let's go back. So then the point is, you have this random walk, you have transition probabilities, that gives you a Laplacian. Laplacian is just the graph Laplacian. And you have random walk. It comes just from the transition probabilities. So you start your random walk essentially at scale sigma. You take a mass there, and now you let it evolve. How do you do that? You just keep on composing this matrix with the old kernel. And so you start at k of t. And then you convolve it with itself, that gives you k of 2t, heat kernel of 2t. Take the heat kernel of 2t, convolve it with itself, that gives you the heat kernel of 4t. Okay. And then you convolve that with itself, 8t, 16t, and very rapidly you just need logarithmically many times, and you get the heat kernel on many, many scales. So this is essentially what you do. See, here it is. You know, have diffusion at time 2 to the J. And you do that on manifolds, and then you're paid to be either an elliptic PDE or a differential geometer or both. So now, the point is, for the Laplacian, you have eigenfunctions. So the only difference between the computer science literature is they call them eigenvectors, but that's all they are, is eigenfunctions. Let's see what the eigenfunctions do. So here's the heat kernel at time t. It has this form. This is a closed form for any heat kernel. And now what we're seeing here is six eigenfunctions of the Laplacian on the unit dumbbell, right? This is a dumbbell. Okay, and these are, so I'm taking the surface of this, or they are taking the surface, and they're computing the standard eigenfunctions. And these have something to do with Fourier analysis. And if you look at these things, you realize, you see this one, it's going from blue to red. Somehow there's not much help, but it's somehow negative there and positive there. And this one you can see very well, there's a coordinate going in this direction. And the answer is you can parameterize this manifold by a very small number of its eigenfunctions, just the eigenfunctions itself. Okay. Now these guys, Bérard, Besson, and Gallo, realize that there's a very simple formalism, and so this is in 94 in geometric and functional analysis, that there's a natural embedding for points in a manifold into a Hilbert space. So you take all possible eigenfunctions, and the distance is you take phi I of x minus phi I of y, you square that, and you sum with some weights, like the heat kernel weights, and that's a beautiful metric. And what now, so since that is a beautiful metric, you would like to use, just as in this dimensional reduction problem, a very small number of those eigenfunctions, and have those be your new coordinates, and these will be nonlinear. That's crucial. Let's go. So then you parameterize the set. Okay, that's, Bernard has better pictures, so let's go. Well, this is a really great page because, yeah, see? That, I'll actually talk about this on workshop one. The short story is that, so joint means, so this is Mauro's webpage, I remind you. This is a joint project of Ronan Schul, Mauro Maggioni, and myself, and in this we explain why. So one observes that eigenfunctions are enormously robust as local coordinate systems, and this theorem explains why they are robust. And the surprising thing is you go back and you examine the Riemann mapping theorem in dimension 2 for simply connected domains, and you look at the strongest version of this with estimates. It's called the distortion estimates. And there's a uniformization theorem for arbitrary manifolds in arbitrary dimensions. It's local. It's not a global one. And it's exactly the same that if the here you need a normalization. The volume of the manifold is normalized to be 1. Then you can blow up local patches, which are balls, to size 1 by picking the correct eigenfunctions. And this will be an almost distortionless uniformization. Goodbye Lipschitz constants. Okay. This is for Bernard. So the problem is actually numerically finding the eigenfunctions is hard because they localize. So this is an example where we're finding coordinate patch on a Euclidean domain by local eigenfunctions. Okay, let's do now the following. Let's go over to.
So is it fair to say that this is where the biggest numerical challenges are?
this is the, well, I used to be sure that this was the big numerical challenge. Now I'm not so sure.
Could it be the bigger ones?
No, it may be less severe, but there is certainly a huge numerical challenge. Here it is. Find a fast solver for eigenfunctions. It's really tough. Right? So, do you guys have fast solvers?
No.
They have Lanczos methods, and then, as I said, it's one for the hills. They're pretty slow, and it's tough. So this, I think, is probably got a lot of interest. If you check around the literature, you will discover that the same problem exists with the PageRank algorithm. It's unstable, and therefore you want to perturb the algorithm so that you have more stability in the eigenvectors. So they say eigenvectors is the same, it's eigenfunctions.
So that theorem you had with Ron, it basically says the closer you get to the boundary, the less there's that RZ.
It says that everything is scale independent. It doesn't matter how close you are to the boundary, if you get blown up.
This is the real picture.
Oh, let's get rid of that picture. Right, that's a great picture.
No, but it's the Whitney cubes.
It's the Whitney cubes. Yeah. It says that these guys, each one of these guys, has a beautiful local coordinate chart consisting of two eigenfunctions of the Laplacian. If the area of the whole domain is one, I can find two eigenfunctions that will blow any box up to size one. So I pick the box, then I have to find the eigenfunctions. And then it blows it up distortionless to size one, or almost. Make sense?
Yeah, the function blows it up to size one.
You take phi 1 of x, so you take z. So you take z, it's a new coordinate system, so you're here, you're on one of these squares. You can pick eigenfunctions phi 1 of z and phi 2 of z, then blow this square up to size 1.
Without distortion.
Without distortion. So of course the distortion has a universal bound.
You mean that?
Yeah, but
distortion, you mean the ratio of
analysts without distortion.
So it acts like a linear
mirror. Distortion with the ratio of the image that I would think.
No, this is the difference. This is it looks like a dilation. Yeah, it looks like a homomorphic. I wrote a paper with Svantiansa, and he came charging into my office at Chicago with a red face, and he said, "Peter, you just used the subindex I to mean five different things on the same page." And I looked at him, I said, "So you're not an analyst, eh?" Yeah, so of course, Rick has exactly the sense of distortion that I mean, that it looks like a Euclidean. Let's go over now to Stefan. Because I just want to show you some super cool
demos.
Yeah, go to demos. Now we just have fun for the rest of the program, right?
Okay.
Here we are. So let's don't start it. Oh, damn. So what are we going to do? So this is Stefan. And I can't remember. One is Amit Singer and one is Shkolnitsky. So there are these three guys. And they put on these hilarious Japanese cartoon masks. And here's what they do. So you can find the full video somewhere. So they sit in front of a camera, so it's a video camera, and they're going like this. You know, and they look really silly. Okay. You take three such movies, and they're not doing the same motion. Each person gets to go sort of like this as he wishes. Now you take this video, you just cut it into a certain number. Each video for here, here, and here is cut into a certain number of frames, and then everything is thrown up in the air and totally randomized and fed to a computer. And then you ask the computer, organize this. So what it does is it it builds a natural distance function. So there's a little bit of art on how you would do that because you have three different things, but there's a natural way to do that. And then you build this Laplace operator and you pick some eigenfunctions, and now it's a shame, but Rahman gets to have the fun of moving his finger. It is aligning all the pictures. Watch this. So if you just look at this guy, as you move around, you'll see his head. So move it around, you'll see his head move continuously. But it's simultaneously aligning it with the same thing for here. It knows to align it. Okay? It's so cool, I should just stop there. I mean, I think this is the most wonderful demonstration.
So what was the data that was fed into the data?
You feed it images. So you have a video, you cut it, each video into
frame is a grid also?
Each frame is an image. You see the full image.
A genus function of variables?
It's roughly. Well, yes and no. As you take the video, yeah, it's moving around continuously, but then what we do is we take the images and we reorder them randomly.
But each image, is it a continuous function of the variables, or is it?
It's a set of pixels.
Pixels.
It's just pixels.
Discrete is discretized.
Right. Right. Because we want to do streaming Japanese cartoon videos, right? That's a joke, but no, yeah. So everything is done in pixels because you need a representation of it living somewhere in Euclidean space. It's pretty high dimensional. Right?
So what is this supposed to do? I'm not sure I understand.
Suppose we forget about these two guys here. So move the cursor around. Just look at this guy up here. See, as you move around, the head is moving continuously. But the computer has been given these images in an unordered fashion and is told, please reorder them. It does not do statistical analysis. It does not do hidden Markov processes. It doesn't do any of that.
Now, I might think that, okay, the specified position of a hard point, which is the head, needs three Euler angles. That's somehow that's your three dimensional.
Well, that has to be, that has to be an output, right?
And this is 2D.
But it's more complicated. I mean, look at the images. There are occlusions, the hair is being hidden. The output has to be three Euler angles.
I get one point corresponding to three pictures. So you put the point.
You mean why are there three pictures?
For each point.
Because the algorithm is given these three things, it's combined in a data set, and then it's told, I want to see if I can align the three different data sets simultaneously.
So there's zillions of individual shifts.
Right, and so the computer does not know that there are three different data sets. It's just given the whole mess.
So it would have been interesting to do with just one of them.
Well, of course, it's extremely interesting to do it. That's right.
Basically,
so just if you just look at the top, that's right. It's a registration, and then it's more impressive because there are three, and it's aligning them.
So the time is completely thrown away.
Time is thrown away, right? And this reconstructs time. Ask more questions. This is the one you should understand.
Why are there only two variables?
So I think, to be honest, I think there are three eigenfunctions, and you're seeing a projection. I can't remember. Arthur, do you remember?
I'm not sure.
Arthur is in theory supposed to answer all questions about image processing and this method, because Arthur does diffusion geometry and image processing, amongst other things.
So presumably the number of the
So it's not perfect.
So the number of blue things is the number of time slices.
Right. So each one of these blue things is a time slice. Well, it's a slice. It turns out to be a point, but it has three. Remember, there are three data sets. So it's actually three different ones. Three different
you first try to find the clusters for each, take one guy and then, I still understand how.
No, if you think about it, that happens automatically because in the high dimensional space that you're looking at, this has to be somehow separated from this. They have to be separated. This one has red, this one has yellow, and this one has black.
Right.
Right, and then you walk around.
I just don't see kind of the.
But then you can give some sort of natural distance between different.
Yeah, distance.
Oh, yeah.
So in fact, they're moving continuously.
Well, between colors, what do you mean?
Well, I mean, from the original graph bit. How do you know that the red and the yellow are turning from the same angle?
You don't. But the computer does it for you. So that's the point. What do you mean, how do you know? I don't understand your question.
Both in the pixels, right? So I just get a big bunch of binary digits for each of those pixels. And think of that as a.
Right, so what you do is each image is a point in a high dimensional space. It's the number of pixels on your screen.
But in this case, if actually find original distance between two images, the construct, Laplace, and.
It's all done naturally. You just embed them in Euclidean space and use Euclidean.
But in Euclidean space, with what? You have your picture is a set of pixels. So
each
what would be the point
okay,
in Euclidean space?
Let's talk about a grayscale picture.
Okay.
So a single pixel makes a value between 0 and 256.
Okay.
So if you have two images, each pixel has two different values between 0 and 256. So you just compute the distance there. You sum the squares. You take the square root over all pixels. That's a distance.
So the time resolution has got to be fine enough.
The time resolution turned out to be fine enough so that this could be done.
You would have got adjusted.
Right. So Bill is exactly correct. If we took too few frames, then the computer would have a very difficult time doing this. It would fail at a certain point. Yeah, correct. It might construct something that's very
time close images are close in the eigenprojection. That's the problem.
Right. Right. So exactly. And you see, this is exactly this robustness theorem that I was talking about, that if you have two points that are close, the eigenfunctions should be a robust local coordinate for these two points. Yeah, so here the remarkable thing is you need so few eigenfunctions.
So there's some explanation there as to how.
Right, so.
So three graphs are done separately and then somehow they match the graphs because.
We're able to align the graphs with the red and black mask to the yellow mask.
How robust is the science? How many number of data can I shrink down to, you know, your.
How many, sorry?
Okay, I mean, if I shrink down the number of data. When does it break down? When does it start failing?
So
I mean, it has more data it has, it has a better chance of cost value.
So it's a question about S3, I guess, or the orthogonal group. So so the point is you would need to have samples where the head has not rotated too far in any direction.
Who told them they couldn't translate?
Oh, they can. That's actually fine. No, they can translate. You can do the hokey pokey.
It's more than S3.
Right.
It's a full group.
Right. So it's the full Euclidean group. It's actually the
piece of it.
Please, more questions. If you understand this applet, right? By the way, what happens to you if you design this applet? Then you're not allowed to really talk about it because you've been hired by Google, right? So Spotify works for Google, and he can no longer really tell me what he does. And this is just a brilliant character and an amazing lecturer. I wish you were here to give this. Let's look at another one. Let's just look at the other demo. Oh yeah, so this is, there are three, I think. Let's see, let's just choose one final one. That could be the last one. Oh, this one is the same. You can find, this is again a registration problem. This is to convince you that there's physics behind it because, let's go to this one. This is very cool. Okay. So what happens is you're given again these unordered pictures. They're just completely unordered. And now I think this is actually, so how many items?
Two.
Yeah, it's two. This is actually two. There's two eigenfunctions, and it has found two eigenfunctions, and so it's reordered the data. How did it reorder the data? By taking the data point x and mapping it to phi1 of x, comma phi2 of x. It's a nonlinear change of variables.
So the logic, original logic was really three-dimensional?
No. The original object was pictures, was images of this type. So there are lots of images, and they're just these images, but they're handed to the computer unordered.
So
and
not,
you want the computer to order them.
So it's not that much different from.
It's not that much different. So let's go look at the
third of it.
But now, why do you say diffusion map? What else is there besides the choice of signal?
What else is there? Let's see. So good question. I just don't know what it is.
Is there anything? You picked the sigma, computed the k, compute, and then computed the
eigenfunction
of the corresponding of the Laplace
of the corresponding
to that k.
Correct.
So by when you use the term diffusion map, what exactly do you mean?
So it is the diffusion operator on the data set. So you have a data set. The data set, and by choosing this kernel, gives you a reversible Markov chain. And you're looking at the eigenfunctions for the reversible Markov chain.
With that particular graph.
But I only got one matrix. Okay.
There's no graph distance anymore. Right. It's now just
and then the mysterious sigma that you won't tell us about.
So I will tell you about it. This is of course a problem because now here's where you sort of have to know something. You have to have some scale built into your problem in order for this to work. Okay, it can't work on everything. So if you have garbage, it'll spit out garbage. First of all, but also. The short answer is you have to have some knowledge of what the appropriate length scale might be for your particular problem. Now, that sounds like bad news, but then there is good news because you check a half, a quarter, an eighth, 16th, etc., and it's not that many. But certainly there is a real mathematical problem there. Absolutely. John? You have your hand up, so. You should.
Intrinsic pleasure.
Or
fish around.
Let's see, where's the sound one? Oh, yeah, so let's just blow this up.
Is this a double sound?
Oh, no. So the sound you supply yourself. So this is a person speaking, and you somehow record the sound. You throw the data unordered again at the computer, and then you ask it to organize it, and you discover that there's actually, if I remember, there's a sound, and then at the same time this picture is taken, but the picture is unknown to the computer. The output that you're seeing is the position of the mouth at the time the sound was made. And he's saying something like, I don't know, at Yale, the standard thing, we had computers that would just sit there saying, armadillo, armadillo. move around. Oh, here we go. Oh no, so this one actually is just the lips, I guess. Okay. There are other ones where you actually do take the music or sound and organize it and then try to align it. So I'm all done, but please just keep on asking questions.
Yes, back what you're saying now that where you one where you do have the sound, so it, I assume it's a similar thing to where you have this through masks, I mean, in the sense of throwing away any correlation between the sound mask and the image, and you're letting the algorithm
right
figure that out by itself.
Right, or you can the simpler version, I don't know if that one has been done, the simpler version is you just take the pronunciation of should sound or something like this by different speakers, and then as they're saying it, you take a video of them speaking. You only tell the computer the audio portion, and then the display has no audio portion, just the video.
Now, if you have noise, for example.
Very good point.
You can
must be robust under noise.
Well, yes? Using Gaussian, you can use it non-local beams or something.
Oh, and very good point. So, free. Okay. Could we go back to the very first slide of Mauro? So, and we'll see that there's actually been some hocus pocus here. Yeah, so let's go down and find k of xy. So keep going. Keep going. Oh, here it is. Okay. So one of Stan's questions, I think, is why that, right? No reason.
It's easy, but it's not the best.
It's not necessarily the best. No one says you have to use this. And I think you're exactly correct that in certain physical situations, you would not want to use that. You get to decide which kernel you have. Basically, as soon as you have enough polynomial decay in the kernel, going to work. Okay, so it's robust with respect to that, but certain kernels may be better, and no one says the kernel has to be exactly the same at each point. We can actually make it non-symmetric.
So you also introduce more parameters.
Yes.
That you can then mysteriously
right
adjust.
Exactly. Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Make it more non-linear. The kernel depends on the signal.
Correct. Yes. Yeah, so what? There's actually been one thing that I've been sweeping under the rug, which is when you use this kernel, you usually want to adjust the density. So if you have lots of points in one ball, you count them as one point.
So if I take a nice smooth surface,
yes,
right, and sample it very, very non-uniformly,
yep,
I'm going to get into trouble. If I don't do exactly what you just said, correct?
No, you won't. You won't get into trouble. You will simply have diffusion, heat diffusion with non-constant coefficients. It's exactly built for, and in fact, it's exactly built for doing
it. It's a different and better.
Right. That's right.
But yeah. It'll still be faithful.
Correct.
Yeah.
It'll be faithful to that. How are they numerically?